Thank you for downloading this Sparkwood in 21 podcast. We are from No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We are discussing the television series Twin Peaks.
Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. If you haven't seen the show, we would love to have you listen, but don't listen till you catch up. You have been warned.
Okay, let's go ahead and get right into recap.
Please, for the duration of the podcast, stay on the bike and don't steal the corn. If you can manage to do both of those, we'll all have a good time. Yeah, don't be corn thieves.
Too late. We are discussing Twin Peaks Season 2, Episode 3, The Man Behind the Glass. This episode was written by Robert Engels and directed by Leslie Linka Glatter. What are your thoughts on this episode before we get started?
Well, I don't think this is the one where the season really shits the bed or anything like that, but it's kind of the signs are there. It's kind of like when you're driving in a really nice neighborhood or a nice section of town, and then you start to go into the crappy section of town. There's no, like, you know how they say it's the wrong side of the tracks? It's not really like that. There's little signs here and there. First you see kind of like, you know, a not so nice house, then you see a crappy trailer, and then, you know, you keep going. So I think this episode gave us our first crappy trailer, and but we're not quite there yet. We're not quite to the bad.
Okay, the episode opens with Ronette amidst a fit. She has pulled out her IV. Truman is already on the scene, and he's pretty handy with the medical equipment because he turned something off without even being prompted to. I was wondering if that was safe, actually.
Yeah, she's having a Reagan moment. I expected her to start spitting at the doctors and saying, "I don't want it, fucking bastard."
Cooper and Albert arrive on the scene. Albert notices that it looks like blue dye inside the IV bag, and Cooper immediately checks Ronette's fingers. He uncovers the letter B, and Cooper tells Truman and Albert about the visit from the giant and the clues he was given. And Albert asks, "Any relation to the dwarf?"
Actually, there is, Albert. But we could talk about that at another time. So this scene is kind of confusing to me because why did the killer come back in to do that? Why didn't the killer do that at the site?
I've never really thought about this scene very deeply until I just always took it for granted that Bob did that. That's just what, and I don't, why would he wait to insert? You're asking why would he wait till now?
Why would whoever did it wait until now when, you know, Ronette's already in the hospital and they could be caught? You know, because they're trying to leave some sort of cryptic clue so they can piece these words together for whatever their, you know, nefarious reason for doing it is. But why wouldn't you do it? Was an oversight? You know, did you just forget? But I guess you could answer the question that Ronette was always intended, or maybe Ronette wasn't intended to die, but now she is. You know, she's going to die at some point, and then the, you know, letter under the fingernail becomes an imperative for the killer. I don't know. I'm just speculating here.
Yeah, this is where my speculations start to really fail because I don't remember a lot of this season, you know, as much as I remembered about the first season. I don't know if we were supposed to think that her life was in jeopardy now at this point, if it was supposed to be a warning.
Well, because the first two times you see letters under the fingernails, they're from dead girls.
Right.
So, and Ronette's not dead. So,
well, why do you think?
I don't know. This is season two of Twin Peaks. So I'm approaching this, you know, head on. I'm going to give everything the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, I'm not just going to be like, oh, well, this was crappy or that was crappy or anything like that. I think everybody who's listening to this podcast knows about season two and the ups and downs, for lack of a better term, to be nice. So I'm not just going to pass everything off. But at the same time, I put limits on how far I'm going to look for hidden meanings and things that connect to other things in some sort of meaningful fashion.
I don't know. I mean, because this is second season and they were starting to get pressure from ABC to reveal the killer. So maybe they had to speed up the process. And so maybe that's why they created this scenario with Ronette having, so they could put the letter B under her nail so they can get closer to spelling out this Robert Bob name.
So feasibly, there could have been a third victim they could have found somewhere else, and that victim would have had the B.
Right.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Because, I mean, there are going to be significant story changes if they're asked to force it, you know, or to speed it up.
So, yeah, I'm thinking that's my guess. It's more of a practical thing.
It makes sense, though, unfortunately. Yeah. It's unfortunate because it kind of leaves the viewer scratching their heads, you know, trying to scramble to make up your own theory so everything stays consistent and in world or in universe. But, I mean, it's probably most likely what you said.
Unless somebody else has some insight they can write in, and we'll talk about Daniels during the feedback section. Did you want to talk about Cooper telling Truman and Albert about the giant, or are you just done with the scene?
No, I mean, he kind of explains it. There's nothing, I don't think there's too much subtext to that, but I
Yeah.
think it's important that he's letting him in on it.
Right.
That it's, so maybe there is a little bit of subtext there as far as him being frank and forward with these two about, because he said he, before he mentioned that he's a strong receiver. So, of, I guess psychic missives, maybe, or signals of some sort.
Yeah, I think he said he was a strong
Or a
sender.
strong sender. Okay, I stand corrected. He was a strong sender. So he's ventured into that territory a little bit, like baby steps before, as far as talking to other people about it. But after watching Fire Walk with Me and, hearing him say this, I think it's kind of a big step for him to admit, like, look, I was visited by a supernatural entity, and this entity told me three clues, and one of them's already come true, so I'm gonna listen to what this guy has to say, even though you're gonna balk at me. Even though really it's just Albert balking at him, and I think Truman is kind of like, huh, really? Because Truman's probably in the position of like, well, I can't call bullshit on this because this guy kind of just came into town, and everything that he's, done has had some merit to it, so.
So Donna visits Harold. He invites her in and offers her things like lemonade and crackers and asks if she would like to wash her hands.
Yeah, Harold's got a bit of the OCD going on. We don't
Yeah.
actually find out here, if we do at all, what his specific ailment is, because he says, he alludes to the fact that he used to be a horticulturist and now he just can't go outside. He can't do it. And so he has some sort of level of agoraphobia, I'd say a pretty high one, but it's obviously not something he's had since childhood. It's developed at some point to be that bad. And like I said, there's OCD mixed in there because why would you want to wash your hands? Unless he wants her to wash her hands because he's germophobic as well. Donna's pretty brave because that's creepy,
Yes. I mean, her motivations is to figure out what happened to Laura. That you think that's the strongest motivation here?
Definitely, definitely.
I still think she's driven by the guilt she feels about her and James's relationship, and that solving this thing with Laura is her way of penance or
But she's also angry at that too, as she expresses to Laura's grave.
which I think that supports my point.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, when you get to that scene and she's talking to Laura's headstone, she kind of lets it all out and she says just as much as you did, and we could talk about it more when we get there, but I agree with what you're saying.
You've already said he used to be a horticulturist, and now he's a shut-in who grows orchids, among other things. But he says his reason for sending her the note was just so Donna could place an orchid on Laura's grave. And if that's the case, why did he write it so cryptically as "Look into the Meals on Wheels"?
Yeah, that's a ruse. That's a cover story. I think he does want her to place the orchid, obviously. But at the same time, I think he wants to still be somewhat vicariously close to the Laura Palmer experience. And he's not going to get it from anybody else besides Donna,
Well, he must be assuming that she's investigating, because why write it in that such a way?
I think the assumption would be pretty safe to make that people were going to be, like looking into this girl's death, Laura Palmer. You know what I mean? So, just because she was so much of a mystery and an enigma in the first place, and he knew that because he has her diary and talked to her about it and saw some of the crazy stuff firsthand. So, I don't think it's too much of a jump for him to go, yeah, people are going to be snooping around trying to find out the missing pieces of this girl's life because she didn't have just a double life. She had like a double, triple, quadruple life.
And he does say to Donna that Laura did say you would ask a lot of
There
questions.
you go.
So.
So, maybe he was expecting her to kind of get to him and she wasn't getting there quick enough, so he started dropping hints.
So he goes to fetch this orchid that he's going to give Donna. And while this is happening, Donna sees a piece of paper protruding from the bookshelf. She goes to investigate and she gets caught in the act, yet neither comment on this fact.
I thought that was pretty weird because he sees her from the glass, the of course the man behind the glass is he's the titular character here. But he doesn't comment on it at all. He doesn't say anything about it. And she doesn't say anything about it. But I mean, it's kind of like the elephant in the room. You're taking something out of my house. And she doesn't put it down, or at least we don't have a screenshot of her putting it down. So ostensibly, we should be believing that she leaves with the orchid and whatever that was, right?
Well, she doesn't get it out.
Oh, she doesn't get it out.
No.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense then.
This guy is very tidy. He's got many phobias, I think. And so this piece of paper being stuck out of the bookshelf, which is obvious, you've got this white piece of paper on that very dark brown background. There's either two scenarios that I can think of. Either he was reading the diary right when she knocked on the door and he hastily put it away, or he baited her.
think it's a test of some sort.
And that would explain why he didn't comment.
Okay.
Or he could have not commented because he's embarrassed of the mess. I don't know.
No, I think the second one is probably the most viable one. I think it was some sort of test to see, like, how snoopy she would get if she was left in the room alone, you know, for a minute.
Okay.
But, I mean, he can still see what she's doing because there's a glass wall right there, so.
He gives her a lady slipper orchid, and she leaves with the orchid telling him she will be back. So now Cooper and Truman are discussing the sketch of who they're calling the long-haired man and the letters RBT. Only four people have seen him, and Albert is present, and he is skeptical, of course. Albert updates Cooper about the drugs found in James Hurley's bike, Leo's shoes, and that Cooper was shot with a Walther PPK, which is James Bond's gun, just so you know. On Albert's way out, he insults Truman, I think for the last time.
Yeah, I believe so, because their next meeting is pretty, it's almost comical in the way that they embrace each other.
Truman manhandles him pretty quickly here because he's sick and tired of it. And Albert unburdens himself talking about Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and about love. And he tells Truman that he loves him. And then he exits, leaving a stunned Truman in his wake. Cooper says that Albert's path is a strange and difficult one.
Yeah.
And we have feedback on this from Daniel.
It's a great quote. It sums up Albert pretty succinctly.
What sums him up? So
That suffer and succotash. That quote where he says, Albert's path is a strange and difficult one.
Oh, Cooper. Yeah. Okay. I thought you were saying what Albert had said sums him up.
Oh, no. What Cooper said about Albert
Okay. So James is released, and he is told he is not going to be charged. Lucy is writing a list of the words that contain RBT. Hawk helps her. Lucy's lunch date arrives. Dick Tremaine, which I've seen him in General Hospital when I was a kid. So this inspires some words from Hawk that have the letters RBT, such as prohibited and robot. That's funny. So now Truman and Hawk are talking to Cooper about the giant when Leland interrupts, telling them that he knows the man from the drawing. Cooper sends Hawk up to Pearl Lakes in response to this new information. And Leland tells them how this Robertson fellow used to flick matches at him. And he would say, "Do you want to play with fire, little boy?"
And he's pretty good at flicking those matches because he flicks one, it does light, and it goes right into the ashtray.
And then Cooper puts it out because he's Mr. Safety. Mr. Safety.
He's also going to be the one to solve the crime.
Is he?
Well, he's the special agent man.
Mr. Special Agent Man. That's how it goes.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's Mr. Special Agent Man. I think it's just Secret Agent Man.
Oh, Secret Agent Man. Lucy and Dick have their lunch date at the Double R. All Dick talks about is work or himself. She confronts him about why he has not called in 6 weeks. We learn about a time spent on a display bed in Horn's department store. He wants to make it up to her and offer some nice clothing in return.
A dress, perhaps, at 20% off. Mm.
She says, "How about a maternity dress?" And he says, "Preggers, I love how her volume keeps getting raised, and it's attracting attention from the diners and the area.
It seems like they've just got a bunch of, you know, truckers on either side of them. Of course, we know that it's not just truckers in the Double R that afternoon, but it's also James and Maddie.
Oh, that's right. Speaking of, James and Maddie are at the diner. He asks Maddie if Donna seems to be acting strange. He talks about how she acted when she visited him while he was in jail. And then he talks about sometimes he thinks he should just get on his bike and go.
Now, did you notice in this scene that the background music that was playing wasn't normal Twin Peaks music? It was their crappy-ass song that they did last episode?
Yes.
And then later on, when they have their other scene, like, they have two almost identical scenes in this episode, and Donna walks in at exactly the right or wrong time, depending on your point of view. And both times, that song is playing in the background. They should have just tacked it on to the soundtrack and called it Maddie's theme or something, or James's ditty.
Well, they probably put a lot of money into the production of that song, so they're just trying to milk it.
Yeah. We're going to get something out of this, goddammit.
Use it again. Yes. Yeah, so, as you said, Maddie holds his hand and just in time for Donna to arrive. She talks of how she met Harold and how he is intelligent and la-di-da, unlike anyone she knows. What is that supposed to mean?
And Donna snaps. James needs to, he got served. He needs to just tip 20% and go home.
Yeah, she says something along the lines, "Why don't you just sit there and hold hands while you try to figure it out?" Yeah, dummy.
She has a pretty legit reaction to this. Mm-hmm. I think I'd react the same way. I mean, you come in and they know she's going to meet them there, the two of them. So instead of sitting across from each other and have conversation, you know, with coffee amicably like friends would do, they're sitting next to each other. Not only are they sitting next to each other, but one hand is on the other. So it's come on.
And he acts so oblivious all the time. And I don't know, maybe he really is oblivious. Laura did say he was dumb.
Yeah, he hasn't done anything to really countermand that. So in my mind.
Yeah.
And that's really stupid. It's just, you know, your girlfriend's on the way. So you're going to sit on the same side of the booth as an attractive girl who's a dead ringer, no pun intended, for your ex-girlfriend. And, you know, she was already making googly eyes at him in the last episode. I think this is just another extrapolation of that. But
next scene, Audrey is being tied to a chair and she's being filmed by Emery and then being shot up with heroin by Blackie. Emery tells Blackie he says they should get rid of her because of what she knows. Blackie wants money from Ben. And then Blackie tells Emery to stop whining. They will have all the help they need. Blackie observes Audrey high and she mentions, just like how her daddy did to me.
This is so messed up. This scene is so messed up. I mean, for a person to do heroin on their own is just messed up enough. But to have it administered to you unwillingly is just, that's got to be criminal. I'm sure it is. But that's a screwed up sense of justice. Like, you got me hooked on cocaine or hooked on heroin, so I'm going to get your daughter hooked on heroin. I'm not going to do anything to you directly, you know, person to person. I'm going to get to your daughter.
You know, it'd be better if she just somehow got a hold of Ben and did it. But
yeah.
And left Audrey out of it.
Or even Jerry.
Yeah, Jerry would actually be more effective, maybe.
Yeah.
So I don't have anything to say about that. It's like there's not a lot of subtext in this, I guess. Or I'm just not, maybe because I didn't watch the episode today, I just don't feel like it's...
There's not really.
I'm not in a bad mood or anything.
No,
you know?
It's just...
I had vegetables for lunch.
There's no excuses here. There's no excuses.
Yeah.
All I could really say about the scene besides what's on the surface level is that Emery really wants to keep his job. He really wants to keep this short and simple and play it as straight as possible, but he's in over his bald head.
Yeah, and she tells him, too late for that.
Yeah. I mean, she's holding a syringe up to his face menacingly. You know, not like she's going to poke him with it, but just, I mean, that's pretty cavalier of somebody to have a sharp instrument in your face. She just doesn't have very much regard for him at
all. Not at all. I doubt many people do.
I can't blame him.
Truman is looking at Philip Gerard's shoe inventory when Mr. Gerard starts to feel a little ill after seeing the sketch of Bob. Gerard excuses himself to the restroom. Meanwhile, Truman visits with Shelley.
Now, I just wanted to say about Gerard's acting, you know, in this, Philip Gerard, whoever the actor is who plays him, does a really good job because he looks like he's having a full throttle panic attack all the way from the very beginning of it where he's like touching his face and just kind of getting, you know, shorter of breath. And then he excuses himself to leave and then he starts shaking violently and, you know, and you don't really know exactly what's happening to him. But we found out later that he has haloperidol, right?
Right.
Is the chemical that he points when he doesn't have it. But he does an excellent job of faking a medical emergency because it made me anxious watching it for a little bit because I was just like, oh, that looks realistic. I mean, I've never, whatever he did in the bathroom, I've never done that. But, you know, thankfully.
Yeah.
But, you know, the very beginnings of it, that's how anxiety feels. And either he has some real personal experience with that or else he's a really great actor or both.
Same as Al Strobel.
Al Strobel.
So meanwhile, Truman visits with Shelley. She says that she's not going to write a statement against Leo. She's adamant. She says she loves him. So they reveal that Cooper's also in the room. Cooper says, okay, Shelley, that's fine.
He knows the game she's playing. He sniffs it out right away.
And he talks about how she may have Leo back one day. The same old Leo she obviously loves. Cooper says it smells like, oh, and it's funny because after he says that and they're just kind of like pushing her out of the room, she's all, what? Which is something like a teenage kid would say, you know. I liked it. But anyway, Cooper says it smells like insurance money and that they don't have much confidence in her, I guess, to dream this up on her own.
But they have no idea who put her up to it because
Right. Nobody's,
besides Norma, I don't think anybody's hip to her and Bobby's relationship.
So meanwhile, back in the restroom, Gerard is going under a transformation and his voice sounds like it was recorded in a cement culvert.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, like what effect they kind of put on his voice because it definitely you wouldn't have that effect just by speaking loudly by yourself. I mean, I know the acoustics of a restroom are very different than any other room because of the materials used in construction and all that, but it wouldn't sound like that normally. So it's being put through some sort of effect thing.
It's got to be some sort of echo effect. You know, as a kid, I used to play in things like that. You know, we used to crawl into cement culverts and stuff. I probably shouldn't have, but we did. And I remember what our voices sounded like
it's
in there,
advisable.
And that's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, I would. I have no way of knowing the correct technical term for what they did to his voice, but it's been altered somehow. But it fits the scene, though. It sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, it's creepy. So back at the Great Northern, Cooper gets off an elevator along with a tuba player and some cheerleaders. And last time we were in New Orleans, didn't we have a tuba player in the elevator with us at one
point?
We
did. We did, because we had to park on like the 80th floor of that parking garage at the end of Canal. And then we were coming down. We were either coming down or going up. I don't remember. But it was three or four members of a marching band.
Yeah.
And one of them had a tuba.
Yeah. Were they playing it, though?
No, they weren't.
It seemed like nobody was playing any instruments when we were in the
No,
elevator.
They were just talking real loud.
Okay. Jonathan is still watching him from behind a newspaper. Cooper tells Ben Horn that Audrey called him. Ben says that Audrey has left home on a number of occasions, which could explain his...
Yeah, I was going to bring that up if you didn't. His nonchalant
concern.
Attitude last episode about his daughter being missing, because most fathers would be freaking out. But this is Ben Horn and this is Audrey Horn, so there's a history of her acting out and et cetera and et cetera. So I guess it doesn't really go too far to redeem him in my eyes as far as having that attitude in the first place. I'm not a parent, but I would assume that most parents would be a little bit more freaked out, and I would hope my parents would be freaked out if I was only, you know, that old and I went missing for that amount of time.
Well, you know, his lack of concern is understandable on those counts, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not justified in a way, though, because, okay, with recent events that have happened to Ronette and Laura, he should be concerned.
Exactly, exactly.
Which Cooper pretty much says that to him. I don't know if you'd already mentioned that.
I hadn't mentioned it, but it's a good point.
And then Ben asks if there is more to Cooper and Audrey's acquaintance and tells Cooper to park his jalopy outside someone else's window. He tells Cooper that he will be his first call when she comes home to roost. And then Jonathan follows Cooper when Cooper leaves.
That's just a weird thing to say to somebody who you could possibly assume is trying to court your daughter, or who, in, you know, Ben's parlance, has more than just the casual passing, you know, interest in her health and safety. It's almost like saying, don't get involved with my daughter. She'll break your heart and then crush you like a bug. Like, who does that? I guess,
well,
Ben Horn.
He's saying
is
more than that, though. He's saying, like, I'll crush you like a bug if you get involved with my daughter.
But
which is strange, because you would think he would be indifferent to any of her activities.
Yeah, why does he care so much that somebody might be, you know, have a thing for her, but he doesn't care where she's at present time?
I don't know. Maybe it's like an ownership thing.
Yeah. Like, he wants her to be safe, but not necessarily happy.
So back at One Eye Jack's, Michael Parks is on the scene as Jean Renault. He wakes Audrey up and he gives her some sugar with a caramel. And he also gives her some more heroin.
He steals the scene when he's in it, I think. He's such a good actor. It was cool that they had him on the show for the little bit that he was on there. I don't think I've ever seen him do a horrible job at anything.
Why does Jacques not have an accent, but Jean and Bernard did?
Jacques does have he has kind of like that Canadian accent. It's not necessarily French-Canadian, but it's Canadian to where he's saying certain words in a certain way that you wouldn't say as an American, or at least you wouldn't say as an American living in anywhere else besides a border state.
Maybe Jacques was a long-lost brother.
Yeah.
Found.
But the young one, what was his name?
Bernard.
Bernard, yeah. The young one, he had...
You can't tell me nothing!
Yeah, he had a super, super... Like, he was just laying it on. And then Jean has a... It's there. You know what I mean? He's a better actor than all of them, so he's doing it the best. But you're right, Jacques, he just said words every now and then that were just kind of like... I mean, his whole sentences weren't inflected with an accent. What I mean to say was he said words that were, you know, so he said words.
Blackie shows Emery and Jean Renault the footage of Cooper at the blackjack table. Blackie's sister is also there. She is Jean's woman. Jean is revealed to be Jacques' brother at this point, even though I already mentioned that. He wants Cooper because he's blaming Cooper for Jacques' death. Blackie and her sister do not like each other. Jean says they cannot let Audrey live now.
So Jean is blaming Cooper for his brother's death.
Mm-hmm.
But
both of them, I believe.
But he can't have, being as smart of a guy as he is, he can't have missed the fact that this guy was smothered with a pillow. Why would an agent of the FBI smother somebody with a pillow? So he's not thinking that he did it directly. He's thinking that whatever meddling Cooper was doing at One Eyed Jack's directly caused his death, which I guess could be true in a certain sense. You know, when you look at it, as Obi-Wan Kenobi would say, from a certain point of view. But
yes,
it just seems like he's smarter than that to blame it on him.
I don't know. This could be another case of them trying to speed things up.
Like maybe if we had gotten the slow story versus the fast story, there would have been more, I don't know, something else that would have pointed him in Cooper's direction and made them at odds with each other.
Yeah, or even if they would have even bothered to introduce this character. I don't know. Like, some things are feeling rushed, and I think because they had to resolve certain things.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have Cooper focused on saving Audrey while also you have to solve the murder.
Anytime you have people who are paying for something and people who are doing something, the golden rule should always be to let the people who are doing something, unless they're doing it horribly and not the way that you want them to at all, you know what I mean? You should just let them do their jobs. Because anytime you try to interfere, nothing good ever comes from that. And I think it goes doubly so anytime you're dealing with artistic properties. Anytime you have somebody who's saying, okay, I commissioned you to make this artistry, whether it's a painting, whether it's a TV show, a movie, what have you. But I know nothing about this, but I'm going to come down and I'm going to meddle in what you're doing and tell you what you can and can't do and what has to be done and what can't be done and et cetera, et cetera. So it never turns out good when that happens. And it's happened quite frequently with TV shows over the years. I won't say frequently, but it's happened more than it ever should have. Because I've heard, I can't think of them off the top of my head, but I've heard of this happening with other TV series where it's got ruined before.
Yeah, it seems to be like a common story.
Yeah. It's so lamentable, too. You know, it's either that or you get canceled, you know.
I don't know if it has anything to do with the fact that a lot of people who run these networks and even movie companies aren't really people who came up in the industries. They're more like people who have MBAs. And so they're just running businesses from a person who runs businesses' point of view, not from an artist's point of view.
I can almost understand that. But if I came into some money, say tomorrow, I go to the gas station and I get a scratch-off ticket and I win $1 million and I decide to go buy a business, I'm going to pay somebody who knows everything about that business to run it for me. I'm not going to go in there and go, just because I have money, now I know what I'm talking about, so I'm going to dictate how you do this. You know, especially if I don't know the first thing about it. So, but anyway, I mean, we can talk about this forever, but it feels like that. It feels like people who shouldn't be meddling in the story writing process are doing so.
So Cooper brings Truman some coffee and a donut into his office. Truman says that Josie is back and that he would like to talk to her first before bringing her in. Cooper says that Truman has his blessing. Hawk updates them about a White House that is boarded up at Pearl Lakes. Truman asks Hawk about Gerard because he was wanting to know if he'd seen him, because he hasn't seen him since he excused himself to the restroom. This piques Cooper's interest. They search the bathroom and Cooper finds the syringe of haloperidol. He says without chemicals, he points.
So when Gerard was having that freak out or fit or whatever it was, you know, panic attack or something worse than that, obviously, he dropped a syringe.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get to inject himself.
No.
That's why we kind of failed to mention that.
Yeah.
But I guess it's more salient to mention it at this point. But so this is where it comes in, without chemicals, he points.
Yeah, he failed to suppress Mike. Mike overcame him.
So now when you see that scene where Gerard comes out of the bathroom, you know, I know we've already passed it, but it almost looks like he's trying to look like Michael J. Anderson a little bit, the way he looks around and his eyes are a little bit wider.
Yeah.
And he moves his head.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
I did, actually. He
takes on his mannerisms to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Which Bob also displays that behavior too.
So it's something about dwellers in the lodge.
Yeah.
That when they're in the real world, or not even when they're just in the real world, anytime the screen, you know, anytime the camera's on them, they're going to behave in a certain fashion.
So Ed and Doc Hayward discuss Nadine's current condition. She has ripped the restraints off recently, and she needs them for her self-protection. So Doc Hayward tells Ed to sing to Nadine. So Ed begins to sing On Top of Old Smokey when she begins to grip his hand fiercely and bust the chains of her restraints. She sits up and claps and sings a cheer. She has awoken, and she thinks she's a teenager. She says, "You are only 18 once," and Ed looks dumbfounded.
This is the crappy rusted out trailer with the car with only one wheel on it in the driveway. It's the beginning of the bad neighborhood. This storyline, we were talking about it earlier, and there's an earlier David Lynch directed and written episode.
I believe it's that
episode. Okay, well, he was still heavily involved at that point. It wasn't absentee, you know, writing and producing like it is now. So there's a scene where she's doing the rowing machine at her house, and she's pissed off at Ed because he spills the oil, and she pulls that back like no, like Arnold Schwarzenegger wouldn't be able to do that, you know, and she's just bending the thing back and then curling it around almost. So we've had hints before, possibly at least, that she could have some sort of supernatural strength. But you had brought up a good point that this could have been Lynch or Frost or both, you know, parties' way of letting us know that she was expressing a really, really deep emotion. And it was just a physical manifestation of that, not necessarily meant to foretell something that was coming in the future. But now you have these other writers who are taking these characters in their own directions, and they might be going, well, remember the time when, and they go back to that and say, well, here's a storyline. What if she comes out of this, you know, self-induced coma with all the sleeping pills she tried to take, and she wakes up with Hulk-like strength? How could that play out? You know, and I don't know. What are your thoughts?
you know, I'm not so, like, there's other storylines that bother me more than that one. I think it's an interesting exploration. Maybe if we had seen another season, maybe it would have had some sort of reverberations.
Some word.
It would have maybe more positive results in her adult life. Maybe she, maybe the people involved are into psychology, and you know, Nadine's got her issues, and why not like take this character through a journey where she gets to kind of relive that time in her life that was so
bad for her the first time.
It's just so integral to what's happening now, and see how that changes her when she comes out of it. But we don't really.
I agree with what you're saying. There's a lot more tangent-like storylines that are worse that happen in the future in the show.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't really bang this one too hard. But this is the first one that comes up that's entirely comical in my point of view.
Yeah.
Because you've had the Twin Peaks quirkiness, the Twin Peaks humor, a little bit of comedy, but there's always been this dark edge to it. And now we get this first outright, like, goofy, comical scene, and it feels a little bit out of place.
It does. It definitely does feel out of place. I think they could have done it, but maybe did it a little bit darker.
I'm just trying to put myself in, like, Everett McGill's shoes when he's reading the script. And up until this point, he's been this really stolid, salt-of-the-earth type guy running Big Ed's gas barn and stuff like that, one of the bookhouse boys. And everything that he has to say is really somber and direct and full of kind of a age-worn wisdom. And here he is in a hospital room holding on to his wife's hand, and she's breaking chains like she's some sort of, like, supernatural gladiator. I mean, it's got to be weird.
I think it's weirder.
Yeah.
Cooper and Truman visit Jacoby in the hospital, which he has redecorated to his liking.
Would they really let you do that in a hospital? I know it's neither here nor there. It's a TV show. But
probably,
like,
not to that extent.
Lighting the candles and bringing all this. I mean, you can get like a teddy bear and maybe your own blanket from home or something. Maybe not even that because of infection control issues. I don't know. But that he had the place decked out. It was just like his house, basically.
And his wife was there.
Yeah, we find out that he's married, which adds a whole new level of creepiness to Dr. Jacoby, because if he had this little, like, prostitution light relationship going on with Laura with the tapes and everything, but he's married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good for you, Dr. Jacoby. Good for you.
Jacoby guides Cooper in hypnotizing him. Now, Jacoby smells engine oil at the park, and they skip over the fact that he had smelt it in the hospital. There's no mention of that. They go into talking about his experience at the hospital.
But he's already said that he smelled engine oil when they interviewed him at the hospital.
Right.
So maybe they felt like they didn't need to reiterate, and it was more important for the audience to know that he also smelled engine oil at the gazebo.
I don't know. I think he should have said it again. We have some feedback on that as well, and we'll get to that here in a minute. But he does recognize Jock's killer. He doesn't say right then who it is. And so next we got Donna. Donna brings the orchid to Laura's grave. Donna talks about James, confronts her about Laura's problems and how they just keep hanging around.
I think this is a turning point in the show as far as the focus of what's going on, because Laura Palmer's already dead And Donna kind of spells it. I think Donna is spelling out the intentions of where the story is going to go from here. We're going to stop focusing so much on Laura Palmer. She's still going to be a part of the story, but it's going to be more about the individual citizens of Twin Peaks mm-hmm. and their weirdness and how they relate to each other. So it's going to be more about the town from now on, because she kind of just says, I'm fed up with, you know, it felt like when you were alive, all we were doing was trying to solve your problems. And now that you're dead, we're still trying to solve your problems. We can't focus on me. We can't focus on James or Maddie. Nobody can live their lives out in a natural way. We all have to kind of try to pick up the puzzle pieces of what you left behind.
That's good acting from her, too.
It was, especially when she had nobody to act off of. It was just a tombstone.
James visits Maddie at the Palmer household.
Wah, 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 wah.
His mother has come home. They kiss. Maddie and James kiss. Of course, Donna walks in and sees this. And then James destroys a lamp or something on his way out after her. Donna takes off before James is able to catch up. I remember, like, I think early on I had thrown around the idea of, like, if they had ever cast his mom, if they had Cheryl Lee. But they actually did apparently cast a woman to play his mom, and I guess they had filmed some scenes, but...
It wasn't Cheryl Lee.
No.
How would they be able to pull that off? Would it just be like an age advancement type thing?
Oh, no, that was my idea. Yeah. So I just thought it would be funny.
Yeah.
Mommy issues.
Yeah, thing. Big time.
Yeah,
big
so time, but... it's not really neither here nor there, because that was came out of my brain.
Yeah. You should have left it in there. But I'm totally kidding. This scene is just another bad move by James Hurley. He just can't. He's attracted to Maddie. Maddie's attracted to him. And he keeps putting himself in situations where he's alone with her. He can't find Donna. So ostensibly, we think he's coming to the house to find Donna because she's hanging out with Maddie. But he knows when he drives up there and doesn't see her van, which I guess she's driving a van now because it's the Meals on Wheels van, which apparently she's just using as her own personal ride, because when she tears out of there, you know, she's in that van, right? I mean, that is the Meals on Wheels van.
I don't remember. I watched this earlier in the week. I don't remember.
Yeah. I don't know, because I don't remember seeing her pull up in a certain vehicle. But when they were loading, well, no, that was in Fire Walk With Me.
And it was a station wagon.
It was a station wagon in Fire Walk With Me. But anyway, whatever it is, he doesn't see any vehicle that could conceivably be Donna's when he pulls up to the...
Because Donna's not there yet.
Palmer household. So he knows that she's not there. So he keeps putting himself in positions where he's alone with Maddie. And she's touchy-feely to begin with. I mean, right away, she invades his personal space after he says, my mom's here, and she's all messed up and everything. And she's just, like, right up in kissing distance. And he's not doing anything to thwart this. And if Donna hadn't shown up, they would have started some heavy petting, I think.
Yeah, I think it would have progressed. Mm-hmm. Because he was needing some loving.
And he chases Donna out into the street, and he's like, why? Come on, dude. Come on.
Yeah, he's dumb. So Maddie unloads her problems to Leland. She is crying because people think she is Laura. Leland comforts her, and he says, if only life could be like those summers at Pearl Lakes. Cooper and Harry arrest Leland for Jacques' murder.
See, Leland in this scene is the best Leland. I think he's the Leland who he could be and the Leland who he wants to be. And I think the Leland who he would be if he was free from the influence of Bob for his whole life. I think underneath it all, he's a good person. And this is a glimpse into the father, the uncle, the husband, the, you know, good citizen that he might be. Even though he does engage in some nefarious activities with the Horn brothers as far as legal finagling is concerned. We'll set that aside because everybody has their professional life and everybody has their personal life. But I think as a person, I'm getting long-winded about this, but
it's okay.
As a person, this is who Leland really is. And I felt like he was comforting her in a very nice way, and after watching Fire Walk With Me, in a very appropriate way. So, and I liked it.
Yeah.
And the scene just gets, it's another rope-a-dope scene, because you get this feeling of like, oh, okay, we're kind of getting to this point where everybody can reconcile and people can comfort other people who are being hurt. And then the coppers show up and say, you're under arrest for the death of Jacques Renault.
I don't know. I for me, it's just because I'm not that close to any of my uncles. Mm-hmm. You know, I like my uncles and stuff, but I would be really weirded out if they comforted me like that intimately. I'm not sure if other people are that close to their uncles.
I think it's different. You know, I mean, it's different for every family. That's your experience. So you're going to think that that's weird. But I think in this family, we've already gotten a sense that she's accepting of that kind of, you know, because he puts an arm around her and she leans in.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know. I didn't see it as Leland doing it.
You didn't?
No.
Hmm. Well, how's it feel to be wrong?
Okay, so after this comforting moment they have together, Cooper and Harry walk in and they arrest Leland for Jacques' murder. So this is where the reveal of who the if whether or not Jacoby saw who the killer was.
It also tells us something else because there was a little bit of debate about whether or not it was Leland or Bob that did the murder. So it could still be either one, but if it is Bob, that brings us to another question about Leland being fully cognizant of everything that happens when Bob's inside of him. Because we kind of speculated that sometimes he
I
might
just
be
don't
able to
think Leland's
forget.
there right now. I think it's all Bob.
So you think Bob has just been there pretty
Bob's
much.
in charge right now.
So like once Leland
Even
found
when he's
out.
comforting Maddie, that's Bob.
So you think that basically, more or less, whenever Leland found out that Laura was dead, Leland checked out and Bob's been there the whole time.
Ever since his hair turned white.
Ever since, okay, all right. I could go with you on that because that would make sense too. Because I know I just made a strong case for, it this being the real Leland. You know what I mean? But let's say that I'm completely way off base, which is totally possible, and it is Bob. It would make sense that he would say, you just want things to go back the way they were. I do too. Because Bob was living it up before all this happened.
And he says to be like those summers at Pearl Lakes, which, apparently was traumatizing to Leland. So why would he want it to be like those summers at Pearl Lakes? And he says that to Maddie while he's comforting her. It's very strange.
Yeah, especially because we only hear about Pearl Lakes in reference to Bob in this episode. So, yeah, I think my theory is wrong and yours is right about him being Bob the whole time.
And we've got more feedback about that too. So Donna goes and visits Harold because she's left James, and she needs someone to talk to, I suppose. And that's the person she thinks of. I guess who else would, I don't know. I wouldn't have gone to his house, but she does.
I wouldn't have gone to his house in the first place,
But she.
but from her point of view, I could see that as being a viable option.
Maybe she feels comforted in the fact knowing that Laura hung out there all the time.
Well, yeah, Laura, I mean, I think she's probably gained an idea or at least a feeling that Laura was using Harold as a pro bono therapist. And not necessarily pro bono. She wasn't paying him, but he got something out of it because he was able to live through Laura vicariously. And I think he's accepting of Donna's presence in his life because now he gets to keep doing that and he gets to learn more about Donna too. Because I mean, when you're a shut-in, I would assume that any contact you have with people, you're trying to leech as much life off of them as you can because you're not walking outside and having any of it yourself.
Right. He's got a lot of books. I mean, he likes learning about other people's lives. So this is just another method or medium that he can do that through.
Yeah.
And he quotes Laura to Donna, "Donna Madonna, there is always manana." And this comforts her, relaxes her.
It's actually pretty upbeat and uplifting. I said it to
Yeah.
myself after I watched the episode, and I was just like, that's a good way to look at things when you're having a bad day. I think I'm going to try it next time.
This comforts her. That he leaves her to go get her something to drink, and she looks around, and then she finds Laura's diary. Dun dun dun. End of episode.
Yeah. I will say this. I think that Harold had the diary out. He didn't, because we didn't see it in the first scene with Harold. We didn't see it till the second scene. So he knew that at some point Donna would be back because she said so, and he said, I'll be here,
Well, I think that was piece of Laura's diary that she was pulling on, wasn't it?
Yeah, it probably was. It looked more like an envelope to me because there was a decent amount of it sticking out, and it didn't look small, and the diary isn't very big. It's more like notebook sized.
I thought it said on it. I don't know.
It could have. It could have.
I'll have to look at it. Okay, so we've got two letters of feedback. So we're going to talk about Tyler's first.
Hey, Tyler. Thanks for writing in. Appreciate it.
And Tyler says, "You mentioned in the latest episode that you were unsure about the grandson the magician's use of the word seemed. I think this is because they know what lengths Donna will go to obtain the diary, which is decidedly not nice. You also mentioned that they may be lodge spirits. I agree with that, but believe they are white lodge spirits. After all, they do give Laura the painting in Fire Walk With Me that leads her to her redemption at the end of the movie, or at least clues her in on the lodge mythos. This may explain why she abstains from Garmenbosia, the old woman he's talking about. The boy is also in Fire Walk With Me and is seen to peer from behind his mask, smiling. I think this could be interpreted as him dabbling in Black Lodge business, which would explain why he is interested in the Garmenbosia, even if he doesn't eat it. Don't take the ring, Tyler." So, yeah, I like that idea. In fact, because the poem with the Fire Walk With Me poem, It talks about the magician who longs to see, and I've come across theories that reference this boy, particularly wearing that eyeless mask, and that actually deepens the mythos and would be interesting to learn about this other, what do you call it? It's not a subculture society, this mirror world that
Yeah, that they all dwell in. Well,
and then there's some, because maybe there's obviously some sort of rift happening in there, because whatever Bob's doing is going against the grain in some way,
yeah, it's breaking the rules.
and maybe Bob and this boy have some sort of relationship that's, who knows?
He's the boy seems to know something about Bob because he points at him. And he says whatever he said in Fire Walk With Me. I can't remember it now, but I mentioned it a couple of times in the last episode.
He says, fell a victim.
Fell a victim, that's it. Yeah, so he knows whether or not there's a relationship between the two of them, or because I don't believe it's an old lady and a grandson. These are physical manifestations. It's kind of like that kid could, in my mind, easily be way older than anybody in there. And this is just kind of like when you're a vampire. In vampire lore, I guess, you whatever stage in life you become a vampire, that's how you stay, you know. So, but anyway, Tyler, I think you stole the corn, but this is a good letter because it brings up a lot of points, and I can totally agree with what he's saying about their use of the word seemed. I can see that because they obviously have some sort of foresight. I mean, they're supernatural beings, and I've kind of put out the theory out there myself that there's good Desnans of the Lodge and bad Desnans of the Lodge, and I don't know if they all coexist together and they're doppelgangers, you know, or how that all works because it's pretty hazy. You know, the glimpses that we get into it are purposefully disorganized and disconcerting. They don't add up to anything that seems logical. You know, whether we see it in the full length feature or we see it towards the end of season two or even at the, you know, the beginning of season. Or towards the beginning of season one, anytime we see anything that has to do with the lodge or the other place, it's always, I mean, they're speaking backwards for Christ's sake, so it's designed to be that way. It's no secret. But I've always thought that there's good and bad spirits, and it would kind of hold that she doesn't want to take the Garmin Bosia because she's, you know,
White
either
Lodge.
she's either White Lodge or she wants to be White Lodge. Or she's tending that way, or however you want to see it. And the boy, he has it in his hand, but he doesn't eat it. So, and we see in Fire Walk With Me, Mike eating it. So I don't know, but it looks like it's happening in reverse. So maybe he's expelling Garmin Bosia. But I mean, that's getting way off subject of what Tyler's specifically addressing. But this is my long-winded way of saying that I agree with what he's putting out there.
And, what do you think about him saying that the painting that was given to Laura was what led her to redemption at the end of the movie? And, the wallpaper,
That's yeah, I was
that's
gonna
One-Eyed Jack's.
that's what I was gonna say. I don't know
It's like One-Eyed Jack's that's, a dilapidated One-Eyed Jack's.
if we go by the Steve Law of Twin Peaks inversion, there could be something in the paintings because it's a dilapidated One-Eyed Jack's. Perhaps it's the opposite of One-Eyed Jack's, so it's a happy place. It's a nice place to go to, and that's why she's, you know, the old lady is beckoning her, like, come on, it's okay. So that would fit in with the redemption theme.
It didn't look like a happy place to
It
me.
doesn't look the painting's scary. The painting is creepy.
And
You wouldn't be able to sleep if it was on your wall, you know, because you'd just keep one eye open looking at it to make sure that nobody was in it, you know, coming through that door. So I'll just leave it at this. I think it's an interesting theory that the painting could have led to her redemption, but I didn't read it that way when I watched it. But that doesn't mean that it's not true. It's just something to think about.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to Daniel's letter. Let's see here. So he's broken it up into some points here. And so he's starting to talk about this particular episode. And he says, I find the beginning confusing. How did the killer get in to put a letter under Ronette's fingernail when Truman explicitly states that there was a 24-hour guard at the door? And why would the killer decide to put a letter under her fingernail now when he still hasn't killed her? Doesn't it turn out that the blue-dyed ivy was tainted with haloperidol, the same anti-schizophrenic drug Philip Gerard was injecting himself with to stop Mike from inhabiting him? There was a crazy theory online somewhere that Leland never came into Ronette's hospital room at all, and that Ronette was, in fact, briefly possessed by Bob to put the letter under her own fingernail. explaining why no one saw anyone enter her room within the 24-hour guard. I really doubt that was the intended explanation, but it's still a mystery to me. Can you explain it? That question made me laugh. I'm like, nope.
Yeah, I doubt that that's – I doubt two things. I doubt that that was the intended explanation, like you said, Daniel, but I also doubt that we can explain this adequately. I mean, we can – once again, like with the letter to Tyler or from Tyler, we can explain as best we can how we feel about it, but we definitely don't have anything conclusive to add. I don't know. We kind of discussed it a little bit earlier in the episode where we were saying that, you know, it's only dead girls that find the letter under their fingernails. Well, they don't find it, but the cops find the letter under their fingernails. So there may have been an intention in the original story writing to have another victim, and they couldn't do that because of time constraints. So they went ahead, which I find hard to believe because of all the little crap that happens, you know, the pageantry and the James Hurley storyline.
Time constraints to solve the murder.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's not time constraints overall. It's just time constraints to solve the murder. Yeah. All right. So different thought process altogether. Scratch that. But I don't know. It's a mystery to me, too. I don't believe that she was briefly possessed by Bob and did it to herself, because she would have had to have had a copy of Flesh World and an X-Acto knife in the room with her.
Yeah. This is where I'd like to, you know, put a call out to other listeners. If you have any ideas specifically on this or anything else, write to us at noship.net. This would be a great thing to contribute to and let us know what you think.
I mean, no idea is too out there. We're talking about Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
So everything can be discussed. But I really don't think that it's that. I really – the idea of that, you know, like an X-Acto knife and whatever else was needed to do that surgically, it's not really feasible. So that leaves us with Leland. But how did he get a hold of Hella Peridol? And it wouldn't be Mike Gerard because when – or Philip Gerard, rather. It wouldn't be Philip Gerard because when he's not Philip Gerard, he's Mike, not Bob.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of X's him off of the list.
That's an interesting idea, though, that it would be him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's the only one that we know of that does have access to Haloperidol.
True. But why wouldn't he just come out and tell the police what he knew? Why be so enigmatic as to somehow get past the 24-hour watch on a room? However he did that.
Well, and he then already knows it's Bob. So, I mean, he could very well put the B for Bob instead of Robert underneath,
He wasn't
underneath
trying
the fingernail.
To, yeah.
And maybe because, you know, he's thinking, you know, he's trying to find Bob, but it's not going to hurt to have other people getting closer to Bob. I don't know why that would get them closer, but he knows that Bob was involved in all that. I don't know. It's stupid. That's the only, he's the only one who has access to Haloperidol as far as we know. So that's my crazy theory. It was Mike.
I only brought it up because of the Haloperidol, you know, which isn't told to us in this episode, but it is told to us in subsequent episodes, correct? That it is Haloperidol inside of the
subsequent,
Okay. So that's all I've really got as far as speculation on that. I can't really think of anything else. It's, you know, I hate to chalk it up to the craziness of Twin Peaks and, you know, like having the writers, because I feel like the parents had left the room at this point in the writing process, and there wasn't the, if you consider Frost and Lynch the adults, which I do, they had went on to go do other stuff, and they let people babysit their baby, and they let the baby have chocolate after midnight, and Gizmo turned into a gremlin, and you know, it's just
no longer cute.
Or was it water after midnight, or don't feed it after midnight? It was no water ever, and don't feed it after midnight.
Don't feed it after midnight.
So I think they gave it water and fed it. They did both, and then this is what happened.
Okay, moving on. This is his next point. I know the actor liked it, but I personally think Albert's speech to Truman was bad characterization. I like Albert as Cooper's opposite audience surrogate, who provides a vent for the reactions of modern viewers, especially towards the cheesier elements of the town. This sudden bit about pacifism and loving Sheriff Truman seems to be there purely to soften his character for some reason, when I feel he should just stay being House. I think he's referring to the character House.
Yeah, I definitely think so.
For a pacifist, he deliberately slams into James's shoulder on his way out. That's a good point.
I agree, Daniel. I agree 100% with what you're saying. But I think that he isn't being softened to the point where he's not Albert anymore. I think he's only being softened to the point where he can peacefully coexist with Sheriff Truman. I think that was the point of all of this. This is just my take on it, because I still believe that in you know, later scenes when you see Albert, he still has his switchblade tongue. That hasn't gone away. You know, people are still getting skewered with his wit, but he is able to get along with Sheriff Truman. I felt like the writers wanted to kind of just put a kibosh on that and say, okay, these two just need to get along because this is getting old. Because I feel like he really is what you said he is. He's the foil to this kind of down home, back country, like, well, shucks, kind of law enforcement. And he's the big city guy with the scientific edge to things. And he's like, this is what this is, and this is what this is. You blithering, hayseed, yokel idiots are looking at it like this, but you should look at it like that. And that's the purpose that Albert has always served. And I think he continues to serve in that capacity. But this scene was designed to kind of make a peace between him and Truman, because perhaps the storyline later on necessitated that they have to be cool with each other.
It had to come to a head.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't have one character browbeating another headlining character.
Exactly. And especially with both of them being so close to Cooper, it's only going to work for so long. So I think they ended it.
And so I think they created this scenario so they can both come out with having our respect still, both of them still having our
respect.
That's
a good point. Yeah, neither of them lose face, but they can peacefully coexist.
Exactly, like you already said. And for a pacifist, how he deliberately slammed into James's shoulder, I think that was more he was like kind of chagrined and kind of just like charged out of there, maybe embarrassed a little bit. And it's,
you're probably right.
In passing.
Yeah. I don't think James. It was an overtly aggressive act. Yeah. Like he wanted to fight this guy, because James would probably just tear him apart, you know, with his
sad, sad face.
Well, you know, he's got that sad, sad biker guy,
his
angsty
sad scowl.
You know, he's like the member of Sons of Anarchy that never got the cut because he was too busy sulking. Anyway,
too busy cutting himself. That's why he didn't get the cut.
He's a cutter.
Yeah. You don't get the cut because you're a cutter. So Daniel's next point is, when Leland is at the station to share his info on Bob, one of the posters on the wall in the background might explain how Andy got his job. It says, is your job a bore? Not anymore. Become a deputy sheriff.
I was going to talk about that because I forgot that he had written about that, and I was going to comment on it, and then I forgot to, so I'm glad it came back up again. You see that poster in the background because they keep going back and forth between the actors in that scene, and you see that poster in the background quite a lot, and it's just a goofy, like, you know, who's who of these fake sheriffs on the wall. I wonder if that's like real, like, propaganda that was used to try to get people to become deputy sheriffs at some point.
Are they hurting for sheriffs?
I don't know.
I mean, they're looking for him, obviously.
Well, this was, you know, the early 90s, so the economy was different.
Yeah. So, okay, another point. It sounds like the demo James, Maddie, and Donna recorded has already made it onto the RRR Diner jukebox, since it's now the background music for their scenes together, which...
Yeah.
We've already covered that.
We covered this already. It's horrible, and they just keep playing it. But it's like Em said, they're just trying to squeeze every last... We spent a whole goddamn afternoon on this, and, you know, we put... Who's the actor who plays him?
James Marshall.
We put James Marshall through hell trying to get him to hit these high notes like a neutered 12-year-old boy. So we're going to make it work, even though you don't hear his voice in this. You just hear the strains of the guitar in the background. But this might be a good time to bring up the fact that we didn't really talk about the substance of Maddie and James's conversation while they were at the RRR too much, because he brings up Donna and about how she's really different and smoking and tried to, quote, do it with him or make it with him.
I alluded to it, but I didn't get specific.
Yeah, I didn't say anything about it, so I'm just saying it now. And I'm glad that somebody mentioned it in show, because, you know, the first season of episode 2, she's smoking like a chain, you know, she's smoking like a chain smoker, and then never again, we don't see it again. So it's kind of good that somebody mentioned it.
Yeah, it wasn't just a dream that we had.
Yeah, I wasn't just hallucinating from too much coffee and donuts.
Okay, so next thing Daniel says is, it's kind of weird how many different investigations are on hold at the sheriff's department, like who shot Cooper, who was all involved in the mill fire conspiracy, Audrey's disappearance, and now Shelley's insurance scheme, which they acknowledge, but nobody seems to have the time to look into. I agree, and I think this, you know, I had mentioned earlier, I think this has a lot to do with ABC's pressuring them, you need to solve the murder, so that they probably had to put things like, and it's just a theory, I don't know if this is true, but they had to put who shot Cooper on hold. Because it's weird how he doesn't seem concerned about who shot him. He doesn't seem concerned at all.
Yeah, he doesn't.
Because even Albert kind of was like, by the way.
Yeah.
You know.
In case anybody's still interested, you got shot with a Walther
PBK.
PBK.
And, you know, Audrey's disappearance is there, but it's, what, we had two very small scenes regarding that. And then
Well, somebody has to make as far as I understand about missing persons reports, somebody has to make a formal complaint about it, or a report rather, and it has to be at least 48 hours that that person hasn't been seen by anybody or contacted anybody.
I heard that's a myth.
Oh, that is a myth. That's a
And I
TV thing.
believe I read that in response to some of the Reddit stuff about the Serial podcast. So,
Oh,
because Hay
okay.
was reported missing very soon after she was missing.
I see. Okay, so I didn't know
Yeah.
that that was a myth.
It's
Or is this a state to state type thing?
it could be safe to say, I don't know if myth is the right word, it's just a misunderstanding that we have.
Yeah.
So.
'Cause I mean, I've always seen that in movies and TV shows throughout the years,
Right.
so it's kind of become like almost like part
Yeah.
of the folklore. Oh, you have to wait 48 hours
And
and
so people probably have people missing and think that, and they could have like got people on the ball sooner. Because it, I from my understanding is like if a certain amount of time goes by, something as short as like 24 hours, like
that's
the,
the most crucial period.
yeah. So it's kind of crazy that you would have to wait that long, and then the trail is going cold during that time.
Yeah, that's counterintuitive. But anyway,
Yeah. So anyway,
I agree with what Daniel's saying here. It seems like there's a lot on the plate and not a lot is really getting solved. But I mean, how would they have dealt with Laura Palmer's death if Cooper wasn't there? So it's all revolving around him anyway. You know, he's the linchpin to all this because they're not, you know, Hawk's not a bad deputy, and I don't think Sheriff Truman's a bad sheriff. But other than that, they don't really have a whole lot of sleuthing brain power underneath that roof.
Yeah, it's true.
So,
Taxing Cooper.
but yeah, there's a lot of fish in the frying pan, and
In the percolator.
a lot of fish in the percolator, and not a lot's getting solved.
Okay, so during his hypnosis session, Dr. Jacoby clarifies that he smelled scorched engine oil in the park where he was attacked, not in the hospital room when Jock died. I think this was emphasized because the burning smell was becoming connected to Bob, and they didn't want to give away yet to the viewer confirmation that it was Leland. And so I remember Daniel had wrote to us about this before, and I didn't remember that. I remember Jacoby being hypnotized at some point, but I didn't remember that they would actually discuss the encounter in the park or the
Right.
attack in the park. But anyway,
I remember us talking about it.
so yeah, so it is, it's almost like quickly even stated, there wasn't a lot of emphasis placed on the fact that he even smelt it in the park.
Right.
Because if it was emphasized, and maybe, I don't remember, but when they, did they bring it up again when they arrest Leland? They say, scorch engine oil was smelled when you killed Jacques. And so that puts you as Jacoby's attacker because scorch engine oil was smelt there too.
But did they ever nab him as Jacoby's attacker?
I
They've
don't
got
think so.
him. Yeah,
No.
they don't, because that's circumstantial. That's not even
So
evidence.
they totally glaze over that.
Yeah, but it's just a way to let the view. It's nothing that could be used in court. It's a way to let the viewer know that that night when Leland saw Maddie leaving the house and he did that really creepy turn and watch her go, you know what I mean? He's the one who followed all of them to the gazebo, and
Yeah.
then when he saw, you know, of course, Jacoby smart, he figured it out. He got there, and then he attacked Jacoby, and which would explain why he was beaten on the back. Because, well, no, I guess it really wouldn't explain that because Bob would be a pretty experienced hatchet man. He would know what to do.
So at this point, all we know is that the scorch engine oil is actually connected to Leland, not Bob. Like, if you're watching this show for the first time, you're not.
True. Yeah. So that could mean. You know, but you already stated pretty emphatically that you believe that ever since his hair turned white, he's been.
He's not the prime operator, no.
Yeah. But he killed Jock before his hair turned white, correct?
Yes.
So it could have still been Leland. But I, you know, it gets convoluted and tangled. But it's a good point to be brought up to be discussed, I think. Because they did kind of glaze over that. There's definitely story inconsistencies here that.
Maybe Leland was still fighting for control at that point when he killed Jacques,
Yeah.
because he did seem tormented when the fire alarm was going on and he had that look on his face. So Bob hadn't fully taken over. So there was maybe a battle going on inside. And then the next morning he wakes up with a head full of white hair.
Well, when he lost the battle. Yeah, that's as good of a point as any. I think there's story inconsistencies here between different writing teams, different focuses on plots in different seasons. And sometimes those inconsistencies get ironed out to everybody's, you know, happiness, and then other times they don't, and there's little speed bumps in the road. And Daniel's actually very good at pointing these out.
I know. Okay, so now his next comment. How is James allowed to just stroll into the Palmer house? He was Laura's boyfriend, but that was a big secret. So Leland and Sarah probably wouldn't know who this guy is, right? And he fucking smashes the Palmer's living room lamp. Terrible house guest.
This is a great point because whenever they did their little concert for each other, you know, their
That
little
was at
recording,
Donna's.
you cut in their demo, as it were, that was at Donna's. All the times they've met up have either been at Donna's or the Double R or at a gazebo or, you know,
Right.
other places. So here you have Maddie at the Palmer household, and this guy that the Palmers don't know just strolls in and then starts making out with their house guest. You know what I'm saying? Who is their niece? And then, like, when Donna shows up, she's able to just stroll in, which is obvious because she's like an extended member of the family, you know, and I'm sure vice versa to Laura, because as we saw in the, you know, the movie and stuff. But then he swipes all that stuff off the table in this, you know, fit of teenage angsty anger and then charges out of the house. And it's like, you know, I would think at this point, this would almost give the lie to the fact that Bob is in Leland right now,
I
because
was
Bob
gonna
would have
say that.
just grabbed him up with one arm and just held him in the air, you know?
Bob, so you're saying that Bob's not in Leland because Bob would have just grabbed him up?
Nah, it's not. That doesn't really hold. It's
Because
just
I
a
think
thought.
Bob's in Leland, that's why Leland didn't really respond. I
Oh.
mean, he didn't respond to like somebody smashing.
So that almost
He's
makes it
on the couch
humorous.
canoodling with Maddie after.
That almost makes it humorous because he's just like, I don't really know these people and what they're doing, so I'm just gonna walk by and just pretend like nothing's going on.
Yeah, he's got the same look on his face that Mike did after
Yeah.
Philip Gerard did not succeed. He didn't have that look on his face, but anyway, yeah, he doesn't know what's going on. So Daniel's next or last point is Leland is definitely treating Maddie like his replacement Laura. We know that Maddie is an adult woman with a car, her own house, and a job back in Missoula who just came to help her aunt and uncle through her cousin's funeral. So why does she hang out with these high school teenagers investigating mysteries and even seducing underage James? Very good questions.
Another good question that the writers of this portion of the Twin Peaks saga probably would not like to have addressed. It's a really good question, and we just have to glide over it because, you know, how is she able to take so much time off and be so far? Because Missoula, Montana, and wherever they're at is a long trip. I mean, you go from Boise, Idaho to Portland, Oregon, it's 8 hours on the interstate. Traveling at, you know, 75 miles an hour. So Missoula, Montana to somewhere in Washington has got to be a hell of a lot of a longer haul. And she just packed up a few things, drove all the way up here, left a job and a house. I mean, who's paying the rent? Who's feeding the cats? What's going on? But
But why is she hanging out with teenagers and why is she seducing underage James? It's like, you know, the innocent explanation would be because their connection with Laura, and that's why she's hanging out with them. And if you've read Laura's diary, Maddie has she did visit, and Laura, Donna, and Maddie had like where they hang out in the tent together, and Maddie brought cigarettes, and they had these. They've had she's Donna and Maddie actually know each other from their youth,
Right.
and so there's that. That's my explanation.
That's the best way that it could be explained is the connection with Laura, 'cause otherwise it just seems really kind of awkward.
I wouldn't actually describe her as seducing James. I think she's getting carried away.
Yeah, she's forgetting who she is and her place and things and just kind of.
Which is why she cries about it later, I think. You know, she's frustrated, but I think she's also at the same time attracted to it.
Yeah. And you know, she's probably not that far removed in age from them because if they're 17 or 18, she's probably 19 or 20. You know, it's not like she's 30 and she's coming back and hanging out with 15-year-olds.
She's early 20s, I think.
Yeah.
So.
But that, yeah, it's a good point to bring up because I watch these episodes and that doesn't really go through my mind, the fact that there's an age difference and she's, you know, because she fits in with them so much that you almost feel like she's just a high schooler from a different town.
Yeah, you
But
forget she's an
until
adult
you
woman who
forget.
has a job and an apartment and all that stuff. Yep. All right, so that's it for our feedback section. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Tyler. Please keep writing. It's always a pleasure. So, and anybody else wants to write in and, you know, chip in any, especially, why do you think Ronette had a letter B put under her fingernail when she's still alive and well? So, well, not well, but alive.
Yeah, alive at least.
Yeah. So, yeah, that would be a great way to start a conversation. Anyway, that's it for this podcast. All right. I am your host, M.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.